Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartzschrauber. On today's show, we're talking about Uber because we needed an excuse to have Jared Meyer back on the show. Longtime listeners of this program know he is our resident ride-sharing and sometimes other sharing economy topics expert. That wasn't English. So Jared, welcome back to the show. I've introduced you many times as research fellow at the Manhattan Institute, but that is no longer accurate. So what is your new job?
I'm a senior research fellow now with the Foundation for Government Accountability.
And are you basically doing the exact same shit as you were before?
No, we're working a lot more on the state level and working on removing regulations that keep people out of work and dependent on government.
But in terms of your role on this podcast, literally nothing has changed.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Great. Awesome. So you're still adjunct podcast, whatever the hell. We'll come up with something. I mean, you know, one of our coworkers just joked that we should be paying for your health insurance at this rate. But anyway, right before Christmas, when you were all doing your last minute Christmas shopping and either looking forward to seeing your family or dreading it, I was actually looking forward to seeing my family. Maryland almost lost Uber and Lyft, and there wasn't that much coverage of this. I mean, people like you and me who live for tech policy saw this, but what the hell happened?
Yeah, believe it or not, Uber and Lyft almost left Maryland on December 22nd. I mean, this is crazy. This is a large state in terms of population.
It's not that large.
Yeah. Okay, let's be real here. Stop exaggerating. But yeah, they had about 30,000 Uber drivers alone, and then add on people who only drive for Lyft. And we're talking about all those people overnight would have been without a job. Yet you didn't see the coverage that you saw, let's say, when Uber and Lyft were about to leave Austin. And I found it kind of surprising, so I wrote a few articles on it. But thankfully, Uber and Lyft are still here. All the DC listeners, if they're flying into BWI, you can still take an Uber back to DC. But this kind of just shows how close a state came to almost kicking 30,000 people out of work.
And what happened? I mean, it's not like the issue is 100% resolved, but what is this like armistice we're experiencing right now?
Well, what happened was a year ago, Maryland passed a law that said the state's Public Service Commission has to figure out if the name-based background checks that ride-sharing companies use are as effective as fingerprinting, which is required for taxi drivers in Maryland. And this law was passed, and the Maryland Public Service Commission reached its decision in late December and decided that, yes, they are as effective. But if the commission would have decided the other way, overnight, all those drivers would have had to go and get fingerprinted, or else they would not have been allowed to drive. This was the deadline for when it had to happen. It wasn't that then, over the next few months, they'd have to go get fingerprinted.
So we've long talked about how Uber and Lyft and other ride-sharing platforms are disrupting transportation, and the main victim of that, if you think in this way, of the creative destruction, is the taxi industry. Why should a taxi driver have to get fingerprinted but not an Uber driver?
The short answer is taxi drivers shouldn't have to be fingerprinted. And my whole point, and this speaks to a larger battle beyond just Uber and Lyft, it talks about if we're going to force companies to use law enforcement tools, because that's what fingerprinting is, as a job screening tool. It makes no sense to use something that helps police find suspects to figure out if someone should be able to work.
Are there other industries that do this? I mean, like, we take it for granted, right? There's a lot of people who say, well, I want to be safe and I want to know that my taxi driver or my Uber driver doesn't have a criminal record. And yes, they should be fingerprinted. And clearly the city of Austin thought that, because when Uber tried to overturn a fingerprinting regulation, they lost and they pulled out of Austin. And I'm going to South by Southwest in 2 months, and I have no idea how the hell I'm going to get around. But first world problems, of course. But, you know, is this really uncommon, right, to have a fingerprint as part of a job screening?
There's a lot of, like, occupational licensing, something that people have been talking about quite a bit. Fingerprinting is a requirement for some occupational licenses. I know when I tutored students in New York City public schools while I was in college, I had to go get fingerprinted. So you do see this popping up time, on certain occupations, but it's not across the board. But the reason why I fight back against this is, first of all, it's discriminatory, but secondly, it's not effective at all. Just looking at Maryland as an example, the database that the state was going to force Uber and Lyft to use by law excludes DUIs and reckless driving incidents. So what kind of background check is that for a ride-sharing driver?
Wait, let me get this right. So one of the goals of fingerprinting in theory is safety. And two obvious crimes that would be unsafe for a driver, like drinking and driving, and what was the other one?
Reckless driving.
they are not, you don't get fingerprinted for those things. So you would not be able to detect whether someone had a DUI if you were to do this.
Yes. And even if you were fingerprinted by law in the Maryland code, it says that you cannot put that into the database that they were going to use. So this is not something that's going to lead to more safety.
So what's the motivation? Actually, let's go back. Discriminatory. Flesh that out a little bit.
Well, what happens is quite often people are arrested and then never charged with a crime, or they're found not guilty. But what happens is, because, again, fingerprinting is not a job screening tool, police departments have a lot better things to do with their time than update all their records. They just want to be able to match prints for if they find it on another scene of a crime, let's say. But when you're using it as a job screening tool, updating those records is very important. And because police officers don't do it and decide to do other things with their time, what you see is that people will get turned down for driving for Uber or Lyft because they were found, they were arrested and then never found guilty. And what they have to do then is go hire a lawyer, go fight to clear their name, and make their case to the ride sharing companies. And when people are doing this for part-time work, supplemental income, there's no way you're going to jump through those hurdles just to try to clear your name.
But can't Uber and Lyft just then still let people join the platform? I mean, if they find out that someone was arrested and they weren't convicted or whatever, and they can judge these things on a case-by-case basis, what danger is there in the fingerprinting in terms of not getting to join the platform? That seems like an elective decision on the platform's part. Yes, the state or the city is imposing a fingerprinting regime, but the platform does have the power to just say, you know what, we're not going to factor that into our decision-making. Why is it there not their responsibility just to ignore the result of the fingerprint background check? Is there something else there? Why are they opposing this?
Well, it would depend on the statute if it said you had to pass a fingerprint background check. But let's say if it didn't and all it said is you had to complete one. Well, then in that case, with the number of drivers these companies are bringing on, they don't have time to go through and relitigate every single case. And also, something that's really important to keep in mind is that when people go and have to get fingerprinted, that's a burden on starting work that falls directly on them. The platforms can't take it off their hands. Whereas the name-based checks that the companies use right now, they pay for them. They don't have the drivers pay for them, because every additional hurdle you add to starting work, when it's something that's, you know, often, as I said, part-time supplemental income, it means people aren't going to go and do it. But if they have to go and get fingerprinted, drivers have to go and find a time to go there, time to pay for it, and it leads to another burden that makes it harder for them to work.
And that's interesting, because we talk about the social justice implications all the time of ride-sharing platforms, and there are debates around the country about voter ID. Making low-income people get an ID is an unreasonable burden to vote. A lot of people argue that. Making people register as homeowners in San Francisco and become part of a database before they can Airbnb, that's a significant burden. And part of the benefits of these platforms is that they serve underserved neighborhoods. So, you know, we talk about New York City all the time because it's a big city, but, you know, the Bronx, Queens, like these boroughs have really been helped by Uber. So there's kind of a consistency around the companies with social justice. And yes, of course, they want to make money and they're capitalists, and that's fine in my book, but they're also kind of trying to do the right thing here. And I guess, you know, two issues you brought up. One, if all you have to do is do the background check, then the easy thing for the companies would be to just eliminate anyone who fails the background check, meaning anyone who's ever been arrested. That's a lot of people. And that includes people who haven't been convicted of a crime or were arrested wrongly or are still in the database when they should have been expunged, as you talked about. But then there's the other worst case scenario where the government actually tells Uber and Lyft that anyone who fails the check can't drive for your platform. That's a much more hands-on approach. So there are two different scenarios. One might seem more reasonable, but both have their issues.
Yeah, and I think something that you see this debate all the time, again, we talked about it when it happened in Austin, is that people hear fingerprinting and they just immediately assume this is foolproof, this is a perfect system. They've just been watching too much CSI on TV. I mean, this is not how the real world works. They're ineffective. They're discriminatory. And as I said, in Maryland and in lots of other places, they exclude the very violations that we'd want to know about to be confident that our drivers are going to be safe. A fingerprint background check's only as effective as the database it draws from. That's the same with a name-based background check, what the companies do now. And they're able to query court records and different public records to kind of get a more comprehensive picture of an applicant's history.
So we've explored the scenario where Maryland lawmakers are just trying to do the right thing and just try to keep people safe, and their intentions are perfectly pure. Now let's turn on our cynical hats, which is very easy for libertarians to do. What else is going on here? What's motivating this?
Well, you brought it up earlier that taxi drivers are required to get fingerprinted. So what they're saying is this is about leveling the playing field. If we have to get fingerprinted, then rideshare drivers should have to as well. But I don't think that's a great argument. When you're looking in, looking at the case like the Maryland Public Service Commission is and weighing both checks, you can see that there isn't much reason to even force taxi drivers to go through fingerprint checks anymore. Thanks to technology, we have more effective, less discriminatory ways to check an applicant's history. And the really only argument in favor of fingerprints is theoretically someone could steal someone else's identity and pass a name-based background check, whereas you couldn't do that with fingerprinting.
Do companies like Uber and Lyft that benefit from asymmetrical regulation sometimes between, do they have an added responsibility to advocate for the deregulation of taxis, right? I mean, it's one thing to say our company's wonderful, we do great things, we shouldn't be regulated. But should they be doing more to make the case that their competitors are also getting screwed? I mean, would that help?
I don't think they have a duty to do it, but in some cases it would help because it would show when they're making the arguments that we're not just looking out for ourselves. This is an issue of fairness that we care about deeply and job creation in general and removing burdensome, outdated regulations. So you have seen when you hear people talking from Uber or Lyft, they say, of course, you know, taxi drivers shouldn't be required to do this either. But with the amount of threat that they're under from regulators, I think it makes sense why they're overwhelmingly focused on their own industry.
Yeah, and it looks like Austin was truly a red line. They drew a red line in the sand and Austin crossed it and they left. And it looks like in Maryland, they were prepared to do the same, which is really telling. I mean, those are big markets. So let's actually move on to New York because you went to college there. I am from there. We love complaining about the government, which consistently ranks really, really high in terms of corruption and wonderful things like that. But I found out from reading your article, and I'm embarrassed to know that I didn't, is that you can't take an Uber in upstate New York. Now, of course, me being an East Coast elitist, in the words of many certain political candidates this year, let's say, I think of everything north of Westchester as Canada, but there is a large state of New York. There's other places besides the city. And what the hell? You really can't take an Uber in upstate New York? Why not?
Well, yeah, we all heard about Austin when they lost Uber and Lyft, but believe it or not, before they left Austin, Buffalo was the largest U.S. city without ride sharing, and that continues to be the case. Rochester, Binghamton, all these different areas, you cannot take Uber or Lyft because there's no legal framework set up by the state. But you can take it in New York City because it's kind of its own animal, and there's certain parts of Long Island, but anything north of New York City, you're not going to be able to find an Uber in New York State.
And that's because there's just a law that says no? I mean, what is this?
It's because they're having the same problem that people had years ago, where they're trying to figure out if ride sharing is exactly the same as all other for-hire vehicles, or if it's kind of its own industry and it's taking, let's say it might resemble it, but let's, Uber and Lyft are more technology companies rather than transportation companies. New York is still litigating this fight that I remember Virginia, for example, solved 3 years ago. Like, they have not been able to find a way to allow the companies to operate. And you hear Governor Cuomo talking about, this is a quote from about a year and a half ago, that Uber is taking off like wildfire and it's one of those great innovations of our time and the government shouldn't get between, you know, job creators and job seekers.
Except my government.
Yes, yes. Yeah. But he did all this talk, but there's been no action. And every year people have tried to legalize ride sharing in upstate New York. And every year it's a new excuse. And guess which one it is this year?
Fingerprinting.
You've got it. So they're going through the same fight. They want to become the first state after Maryland declined to do so to require fingerprinting.
Even though they know that that would essentially guarantee that everyone would leave upstate. Now, are they bargaining with a much stronger position because of New York City? So if they were to pass a statewide law that says everyone needs to get fingerprinted, that includes New York City, which has got to be the biggest or up there in terms of markets in the country. And we've already seen companies like Airbnb kind of capitulate in New York because of how big the market is and not draw red lines in the sand. Is this a situation where Cuomo knows that there's too much money at stake for the companies that they're not just going to pull out of New York if there's a fingerprinting requirement?
Well, it goes even deeper than that. New York was one of the first markets for Uber when it was Uber Black.
Limousine company, yeah.
Yeah, so they've actually always complied with fingerprinting in New York City. Uber drivers today in New York City have to get fingerprinted. It's the rare exception. Houston, Uber operates in where you need fingerprints. Lyft had pulled out of there, but both companies operate in New York City.
So the issue is if you were to expand it to upstate state, would those drivers have to get fingerprinted?
They're trying to extend those same qualifications that are required in New York City, where you have to be a professional driver, a licensed driver, you know, speaking of occupational licensing, to work in New York City.
Yeah, the license plates start with T.
Yep, yeah. Rather than a private vehicle. So yeah. There truly is no like Uber X as we think about it in the rest of the country. That does not exist in New York City. So we saw all the benefits for workers and riders, even though they still have these higher barriers. But trying to move that then to Binghamton, like that makes no sense, or Buffalo. So I think the main thing is New York would stay the same, but there would be a common sense regulatory framework for the rest of the state. That's the fight that's going on right now.
And there are bills on the books that would deal with this. And like you said, they've just stalled over the fingerprinting question. What about the economic cost to upstate New York of delay? I mean, we constantly hear, if you're a native New Yorker, you know that upstate's hurting. And Governor Cuomo has made it a big deal to try to get startups to move into upstate. Varying success depending on your political stripe. There's a lot of disagreement over whether banning fracking was justified, because there's a lot of people who live in New York State who are sitting on, frankly, what is a gold mine if fracking were legal, but it is not. It was banned by the health department. So is this an opportunity for upstate New York? I mean, what kind of economic losses or lost potential, rather, are we seeing here?
Well, a few years ago, Uber came out with a study saying the number of jobs that would be created if the company was allowed to extend to the whole state. They said 13,000 jobs, and you might say that sounds too high, but if you look at neighboring Pennsylvania, that has about that state has the same population as upstate New York, and there's over 30,000 Uber drivers there. So I think it's easy to assume that there'll be at least 15,000, 20,000 jobs created if Uber's allowed to expand.
Now, we're not talking about full-time necessarily, right?
Yes, that's a good point. It's not going to be full-time work, because by and large, over half of Uber drivers work under 10 hours a week. But this is about providing people a chance to make supplemental income, work part-time, or if they want to, work full-time using an asset they already have, their car, where they're completely their boss and they can work on their own schedule. So it wouldn't be all these full-time jobs, but it gives people a chance to supplement maybe the work that they're seeing their hours cut back at the factory they're working at.
So let's wrap up the show with predictions. Getting back to Maryland, you mentioned that the Public Service Commission, do I have that right, came down with a decision that said that the name background check is sufficient, which staved off the fingerprinting, which is why on December 23rd, people could still order Ubers in Maryland. Is the status quo secure, or is this a very bitter situation and there's going to be more action on it?
So if Uber and Lyft change their background check system, they'll have to go back and recheck with the Public Service Commission. So something could happen. But I think in this battle, especially where the public wasn't that involved, whereas they were involved in a lot of other Uber fights, I think it's pretty safe in Maryland right now. I mean, imagine how mad all the congressional staffers or the staffers in Annapolis are going to be if they can't get Uber anymore.
Yeah, seriously. And what about New York? I mean, you mentioned that there are some bills that would legalize ride sharing without the fingerprinting item in upstate, but without touching on the New York system, which seems to work for a variety of reasons because you had so many professional drivers who were willing to comply with the regulations. What do you see happening in New York?
New York, I really don't know. I was positive last year was going to finally be the year that people in upstate New York could take an Uber or a Lyft, but that didn't come to pass. And looking at what happens, last year the fight was over insurance requirements. The year before that, it was on how they're illegal taxis and they need medallions or government's permission to work. Now the fight's gone to fingerprinting. Opponents of ride sharing up in Albany and New York State's capital will pick any argument they can to try to keep these innovative services and these jobs away from their constituents. So I don't know.
All right. Well, we'll leave that with the fact that you are not Uber positive. That's the name of your book, but you're not Uber positive about what's going to happen in New York. But that's it for today. My guest has been Jared Meyer, who used to be a research fellow at the Manhattan Institute, but is now a research fellow at the Foundation for Government Accountability. What is your website there?
It's thefga.org.
Thefga.org. You can find more there, and we'll link to the articles that he wrote that we discussed on today's show. We'll link to those in the show notes. But that's it, Jared. Thanks for joining the show. Again, people missed you so dearly.
Thanks, Evan.
Find this podcast in iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. Please leave us a review. You can follow Tech Freedom on Facebook and Twitter, where we're always putting out super interesting and awesome stuff. Shoot us an email at media@techfreedom.org if you ever want to appear on the show or have some thoughts on how to make it better. We hear your feedback and we're working on implementing it, particularly on this whole debate question, getting a little bit more conflict on the show. I don't think Jared and I disagree nearly enough for your entertainment purposes, but we'll see you next time.
Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.